Okay, good morning. I'm going to call this meeting of the Tahoe Regional Planning Agency's Advisory Planning Commission to order. The date is Wednesday, June 9th, 2021. It's 9:32. And we're here again in our virtual webinar. The first item on the agenda is to call the roll to determine a quorum. So Tracy, if you could do that for us, please.
Mr. Olling?
Present.
Mr. Booth?
Present.
Ms. Carr?
Present.
Ms. Chandler?
Present.
Mr. Drake?
Present.
Mr. Drew?
Good morning.
Mr. Ferry?
Present.
Ms. Ferris?
Here.
Mr. Gavon? Mr. Hill?
Good morning.
Ms. Jacobson?
Here.
Mr. Lesson? Ms. Roverud?
Here.
Ms. Simon? I think you're on mute.
If I can, there, here.
Thank you. Ms. Stala?
Here.
Mr. Teixeira?
Good morning.
Mr. Smokey? And Mr. Young?
Good morning.
Mr. Chair, we have a quorum.
Great, thank you, Tracy. I will now go over the meeting rules for the day, so please bear with me. To observe the meeting, go to trpa.gov. Under the calendar header, click on the Advisory Planning Commission online meeting for June 9, 2021. There you'll find a link to the public webinar hosted on GoToWebinar. To address APC members directly with your comments, please utilize the hand-raising function in the control panel of the GoToWebinar, which you should see under the red microphone. At the appropriate time for public comments, please raise your hand by clicking on the hand icon, and a TRPA staff member will unmute you to indicate that you can begin your public comment. Please state your name at the beginning of your comment. If you've requested a reasonable accommodation from TRPA and have been provided a unique PIN number for dial-in, you'll be unmuted at the time you requested to make your public comment. If you are using GoToWebinar's Instant Join web app, please make sure it is opened in the Google Chrome browser and that you allow access to your microphone in order to be unmuted. Finally, if you've been called into the general attendee line with the access code posted on the website, please be aware that this is a listen-only option. To my fellow APC members, if you wish to speak, you can alert me via the chat function or speak up when someone else isn't speaking. APC members may only use the chat function to indicate a desire to speak. This function must not be used to have sidebar conversations. And due to a limited amount of video feeds available, please keep your cameras turned off. Finally, if everyone could please remember to mute your microphone unless you're speaking to cut down on background noise. That would be great. Okay, let's move now to item two, which is approval of our agenda today. Staff, do we have any changes to the agenda?
Mr. Chairman, there are no changes to the agenda.
Thank you, John. We will deem the agenda approved as it's posted for the record. Let's go now to item three, which is public interest comments. If any member of the public wishes to address the Advisory Planning Commission, please use the hand-raising function now, and you'll be unmuted by a TRPA staff member. All public comments should be as brief and concise as possible. Testimony should not be repeated. The chair has the discretion to set appropriate time allotments for individual speakers. No extra time for participants will be permitted by crediting the time of others. Written comments received prior to the meeting were forwarded to the APC members. I do not believe we received any for this meeting.
Hey, John.
Excuse me, we did. We did receive one public comment. I apologize. Hopefully that was forwarded to all members. Yes, on our ADU item, I apologize. In the interest of efficient meeting management, the chairperson reserves the right to limit the duration of each public comment period to a total of 1 hour. Any unheard comments can be submitted via email to tcampbell@trpa.gov and will be forwarded to all APC members. Please note the Advisory Planning Commission is prohibited by law from taking immediate action on or discussing issues raised by the public that are not listed on the agenda. So I'm now going to turn this over to Catherine for muting and unmuting of any members of the public with raised hands.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There are no hands raised to make a public comment.
Okay, thank you, Catherine. We'll go then to item four, which is our disposition of minutes. We do have a set of minutes from May 12th, 2021 on page 7 of our packet. Do any APC members have any comments, questions on the minutes?
Mr. Chairman, I have none, but I'm asking if any of my colleagues do.
I do not. Thank you.
Okay. Hearing none, Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to make the motion to approve the minutes of the APC meeting of May 12, 2021, as presented.
Thank you, Steve. Anyone want to second the motion?
I'll second, Brendan.
Thank you, Jennifer. Let's see, this requires an approval, affirmative vote of the majority in attendance. I don't believe we need to do a roll call. So all those in favor, please say aye.
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 Anyone object or abstain?
I need to abstain since I wasn't a member at that time.
Okay, is that Ms. Simon?
Yes, it is. I'm sorry, I'll identify myself. Judith Simon.
Thank you, Ms. Simon. Anyone else? Fantastic. I thought the minutes were great, as always. So thank you very much to TRPA staff for that. Let's go down now to item 5, which are our administrative matters. Item 5A is a resolution recognizing former Advisory Planning Commission member Lee Plemmel, Carson City representative. And the resolution can be found on page 23 of your packet. And I'm now going to pass this over to Mr. John Hester to introduce this item.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And before you read the resolution and ask for the APC to approve it, I just thought it would be appropriate, given Lee's long and successful career in planning. I've known Lee as a colleague when I've worked in local government in the Northern Nevada area. He has too. We've also been both involved in Nevada APA over the years, and he's served well on the APC for TRPA as well. Lee's the consummate professional, always put his community first, always collaborated well with other entities, other organizations. He's been a pleasure to work with and he'll be missed. And I just wanted to point all that out before I turn it over to you, because I know at the staff level, Lee has a lot of admirers and a lot of people who wish him well and will miss him.
Very well said, John. Thank you for those words. Couldn't agree more. And it's my pleasure now to go ahead and read this resolution. Lee had a colorful past, so I think this is going to be great to read. This is a resolution recognizing Lee Plemmel for his service to the Lake Tahoe region. And it states, whereas Lee Plemmel has demonstrated his exceptional skills and abilities in a broad range of venues, including as a standout pitcher for Laguna Hills High School, Stanford University, where he won the College World Series Most Outstanding Player Award. And after being drafted by the St. Louis Cardinals, or the St. Petersburg Cardinals, Hamilton Redbirds, Savannah Cardinals, Springfield Cardinals, and Arkansas Travelers, while also performing as the bassist in the band View, which had two albums, Extend Agenda and Replace the Mind. And whereas as a longstanding and respected member of the planning community in Northern Nevada, Lee served the public as a planner for Douglas County, and principal planner, planning director, and community development director for Carson City. And whereas while serving as community development director for Carson City, he represented Carson City as a valued member of the Tahoe Regional Planning Agency's Advisory Planning Commission, successfully completed and implemented the downtown Carson City redevelopment plan, which served as one of the models for the Lake Tahoe South Shore Main Street Management Plan, and acted as the Carson City alternate to the Tahoe Regional Planning Agency's governing board. And whereas during his tenure on the Advisory Planning Commission, he participated in and supported the region's efforts to address forest health and improve safety following the Angora fire, completed the major update to the regional plan in 2012, established the first successful shoreline plan and associated code of ordinance amendments, and initiated the first major update of the Tahoe region's threshold standards in over 30 years. Now, therefore, be it resolved that the Advisory Planning Commission of the Tahoe Regional Planning Agency does hereby express its sincere and deep gratitude for Lee for his service to the public, his community, and the Lake Tahoe region, and wishes him well in his future endeavors in whatever venues he pursues. Fantastic. Let's see, Lee, I believe you're on the line. Would you like to say anything?
Unmuted, there I am. Boy, I wish you could see my face on the screen or be there. I was laughing at the first paragraph. That's funny, somebody dug up the old, a long time ago playing baseball and doing other things. But yeah, thank you for that. Thanks for the recognition. You know, my last meeting there, I know I thanked a lot of various people individually. And so, you know, I won't go through that again, but thank you, John Hester, for your comments. It's been great working with you and everybody through the years. On the APC, there's certainly most of you there have a lot more knowledge about Tahoe issues and certainly the environmental science issues. And it was really fun to be a part of that and learn for me over the years. And I was honored to be a part of the APC over the years. And just thank you. Thank you all. Been great working with you all. I'm going to have more time now and actually probably spend more time, you know, have the ability to spend more time up at Tahoe now that, don't have to work 5 days a week. So thanks again. Look forward to, yeah, like I said, getting to see Tahoe a little bit more now. Enjoy it.
Fantastic. That sounds great. Any other words from my fellow APC members? Please go ahead and unmute yourself and speak up.
Lee, this is Steve DeShera. I just wanted to say thank you again for your service.
Lee, this is Jennifer. So yeah, it's been a pleasure working with you on the APC, sitting next to you around the table when we did these in person was as much a pleasure as having you as a physical neighbor when you lived in Douglas County. So I wish you well, and I think it's a great time to be retired, and you're definitely, it'll definitely be great to spend time doing what you want to do each day. Instead of having to report to work. So congratulations. I'm jealous and I look forward to being in your shoes someday.
Lee, this is Kevin Hill.
This is a smile. I know I probably didn't see this a lot in the meeting sometimes, but yeah. Thank you all. Thanks very much.
Hey, Lee. This is Kevin Hill.
Go ahead, Kevin.
Oh, thank you, John. Yeah, Lee, I just wanted to thank you for all your work at Tahoe, and as a Carson City resident, just really appreciate all the work and great things you've done for our community. So I really appreciate all your attention and passion for what you do, and have a great retirement. I'm really anxious to hear actually some of your past music. So if you can send me a link, I'd love to hear it.
Lee, thank you. It's been a pleasure working with you over these years, and I really appreciate your perspective and your even demeanor. So good luck.
I'll just mention that the photo you're seeing is obviously a beautiful photo of Lake Tahoe that's been gifted to Lee by TRPA. So hopefully you'll enjoy seeing that on your wall somewhere. Any other member comments?
Mr. Okay. Chairman, this is Steve. I'm happy to make the motion to approve the resolution as you read into the record for Lee Plemmel.
Thank you, Steve. I do need to open this for public comment briefly to make sure we don't have any public comment on the item. Catherine, could I turn this over to you if any member of the public wishes to address the APC on this item and address Lee? Please use the hand raising function now and you'll be unmuted by Catherine. So I'll turn that over to you now.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There are no hands raised to make a public comment.
Thank you, Catherine. All right, Steve, would you like to read the motion?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. I move to approve the resolution recognizing former Advisory Planning Commission member Lee Plemmel, representative of Carson City.
Fantastic. Do we have a second?
Eric Young, second.
Thank you. Tracy, could you please do a roll call vote for us?
Mr. Young?
Yes.
Mr. Teixeira?
Yes.
Ms. Roverud?
Yes, thank you, Lee.
Ms. Jacobson?
Yes.
Ms. Stala?
Aye.
Ms. Simon?
Yes.
Mr. Drew?
Yes.
Mr. Drake?
Yes.
Mr. Hill?
Yes.
Ms. Ferris?
Yes.
Ms. Carr?
Yes.
Mr. Booth?
Yes.
Ms. Chandler?
Yes.
Mr. Olling?
Absolutely yes.
And Mr. Ferry?
Aye.
Mr. Chair, that motion passes.
Thank you very much, Tracy. All the best, Lee. Don't be a stranger. Take care. All right, those are always lots of fun. I just love that, the past. Mine will never be that colorful, unfortunately. And let's now go to item six, which are our planning matters. Item 6A is an update on the work of the Tahoe Living Working Group, including discussion and possible recommendation on amendments to the TRPA Code of Ordinances related to A, accessory dwelling units, including amendments to chapters 21, 31, 39, 50, 51, 52, and 90, and rules of procedure section 12. B, non-conforming density, including amendments to chapter 31. C, bonus unit pools, including amendments to chapter 52. And the TRPA staff report can be found on page 25 of your packet for this item. I'm going to now turn this over to Ms. Karen Fink from TRPA to present on this. Hi, Karen.
Hi, Brendan. Good morning, everybody. Karen Fink with TRPA's housing program. So today we're presenting an informational item for you on a draft housing code amendment package that has come out of recommendations from the Tahoe Living Working Group. So today we'd like to get your input at this stage before we finalize draft code and the environmental analysis and bring the entire package back to you for a formal recommendation for approval. So in addition to reviewing the housing recommendations that are in the packet, I'm also going to give a status update on where the Tahoe Living Working Group is with working through a set of actions that the governing board approved in January of 2021. And I will also talk about where we are with the environmental analysis for each element, for each recommendation when I get to that part of the presentation. So, the basic housing package that we're presenting to you today is an initial package to remove barriers to the provision of affordable housing and to better implement regional plan goals. So it's based on what we have heard are some of the most obvious barriers to providing affordable and workforce housing, and areas where our analysis has shown that TRPA can have the biggest impact. So the package includes three main recommendations that were supported by the Tahoe Living Working Group. They include changes to our code of ordinances, our rules of procedure, and three area plans, and they're related to these three bullets that you see here on the screen. So the first one is modifying the bonus unit boundary. The bonus unit boundary is where we want to incentivize development and encourage transit supportive densities. The second is related to allowing non-conforming tourist density to be used for residential density on site. And this is our first recommendation to increase residential densities at the code level since the approval of the regional plan in 2012. And then finally, there's a recommendation to increase flexibility for allowing accessory dwelling units. So this will help encourage allowing this smaller housing type more widely. And then in the staff report, there's also a couple of cleanup code changes related to the Development Rights Strategic Initiative, and I'm not going to go over those, but if anyone has questions, I'm happy to answer questions about them. Next slide, please. So the draft amendments that you're going to hear about today are geared towards supporting three overarching goals. They help achieve the regional plan goal of walkable communities and walkable town centers and walkable neighborhoods. And they also help local jurisdictions meet their regional housing needs assessment requirements in the case of California jurisdictions, and in the case of Nevada jurisdictions, to meet the housing goals that are set out in their housing elements. Those regional housing needs assessment requirements on the California side are also baked into our regional plan. They're part of our sustainable community strategy. So that's the second goal, is meeting these local and sustainable community strategies housing requirements. But those housing requirements don't go far enough to meet the entire housing need. The Mountain Housing Council and the Tahoe Prosperity Center have conducted additional housing needs assessment studies in the South Shore and the Tahoe-Truckee region, and they've identified a larger housing need than has been specified in those regional housing needs assessment requirements. So the third goal is to meet that greater regional housing target. And just some additional information, the Mountain Housing Council and the Tahoe-Truckee Community Foundation are currently in the process of updating their housing needs assessment for the Tahoe-Truckee region. It was last updated or conducted in 2016. And then the Tahoe Prosperity Center is working with Washoe County and partners in Washoe County currently to do a specific housing needs assessment for the Tahoe Basin portion of Washoe County. So there's also other goals in the regional transportation plan and the regional plan that these amendments support, such as supporting economic vitality, helping to increase transit frequency, and encouraging moderate income housing in suitable locations. And then finally, before we move on, I also just want to emphasize that the recommendations that we're bringing forward today are fully within the TRPA's growth caps that were analyzed within the regional plan. So they do not change our growth caps or the overall growth that was planned for in the region. So next slide, please. Thanks. So before I get into the details of the amendments, I want to talk about how they fit into the larger picture of working towards housing affordability as a whole. The Tahoe Living Working Group, the full name of this working group is the Tahoe Living Housing and Community Revitalization Working Group, but we call it the Tahoe Living Working Group for short. This group has been meeting since August of 2020, and the governing board designated this working group as a committee of the Advisory Planning Commission, with the chair of the APC also serving as the chair of the working group. So that's Brendan Ferry. And then several members of the APC also sit on this working group, the local jurisdiction staff. So in January of 2021, the governing board approved the set of actions that you see here on the screen for the working group to focus on. And the package that we're presenting today is the result of work on the near-term actions. So those actions that you see in the first line there, the pink line, the ADUs and density. And then just for a sense of timing, the near-term actions were anticipated to come to governing board for approval within 3 to 6 months of starting work on them. The medium-term actions are anticipated to take an additional 6 to 12 months. And then the long-term actions would take another 1 to 2 years. So this is a multi-year process. And then I want to go into a little detail about how the working group landed on these actions and this prioritization that you see here. So this matrix of actions emerged out of TRPA's analysis that we conducted that showed which actions were likely to provide the most cost reduction per unit, provide actual units on the ground, and also align with local housing elements so that we could leverage actions that local governments were already taking. So TRPA had in-depth one-on-one meetings with local jurisdiction staff to understand which TRPA actions could best support and leverage those that are already in the housing elements. So those three things, cost reduction, units on the ground, and leveraging local actions were what we used to narrow down the list of things that we could work on and prioritize them. And one of the things that we heard through these conversations with the local jurisdictions that I just want to emphasize is that even though the regional plan really envisions sufficient workforce housing in close proximity to town centers and in walkable neighborhoods, it's still much easier to get units approved that are ideal for tourists or second homes, while workforce housing faces additional hurdles through the construction and permitting process. So part of what these actions try to do is to establish balance between getting residential units or workforce units on the ground versus tourist-oriented or second homes. So you'll see that theme running through the proposals that I'm going to go over. And then finally, this package, as I mentioned, focuses on ADUs and density, the near-term items, but this is not everything that we anticipate bringing forward related to ADUs and density. So we heard from the working group that there are more incentives that we could build in related to ADUs and density, but those incentives may take additional time to develop and enough time to work on those somewhat more complicated issues. So we do have the opportunity to spend more time on looking at incentives related to ADUs and density in the medium term and long term actions. And I'll go over that a little more at the end of the presentation. So next slide, please. The housing cost analysis tool. This is one of the tools that we use in which actions to focus. So this is a pro forma tool that helps us understand how housing costs change depending on the actions that we take and how that change relates to affordability for our local residents. So each of the three columns that are shown here on this graph represent a different type of housing that we can focus on. So on the left, there's a moderate density housing and the total cost at the top is the cost per unit to build. In the middle is a higher density multifamily housing type, and on the right is a single family home. And then those horizontal lines that you see across are the dashed lines. Those are the affordability levels for our local income groups. So when we use this tool, we look at how we can change, potentially affect individual elements of the costs. Those are like the different colors that are shown in each column, and maybe bring the tops of those columns closer to the affordability levels for our local residents. So again, this helped us narrow down and prioritize the actions. Next slide, please. In January, the local government and housing committee hosted a workshop on missing middle, providing housing for the missing middle. And I know some of you attended that. So I want to highlight how these code amendments or these amendments that we're bringing forward align with the takeaways of that workshop. And one of the key takeaways was that really kind of emphasizing that planners should keep an eye out for how the layering of different land use regulations can actually preclude housing types that are affordable to middle-income families. So these amendments that I'm going to talk about in a moment are focused on encouraging a diversity of housing types and sizes. And so kind of based on the outcome of this Missing Middle workshop, we did look into our regulations and found that our regulations combined with market forces actually encourage people to maximize the size of single family homes. And in a common scenario that results from our code, single family homes in neighborhoods are incentivized to be as large as 4,500 square feet. So that's generally not affordable to our local residents. So these amendments increase the options of what property owners can do and put in place regulations that encourage homes in a variety of sizes. Next slide, please. Okay, so this is the first recommendation that's part of this housing code package. So this recommendation is to modify the bonus unit boundary to conform to recent planning efforts. So just a reminder, the bonus unit boundary is the area in which you can build a residential unit using a bonus unit, which you can get from TRPA's bonus unit pool for free. So that takes the place of a development right. And that is in exchange for providing a deed restricted, affordable, moderate, or achievable income housing unit. And this bonus unit boundary was first approved in 2018 through the Development Rights Strategic Initiative. So as part of the density action item, the working group spent some time thinking about where do we want to incentivize development and what do we consider walkable? And the group noted that some of our other planning efforts have identified slightly different areas for where we want to incentivize residential development. And the existing bonus unit boundary doesn't fully conform to all of those previous planning efforts. So the areas were, you know, areas identified in the regional transportation plan, so a walkable zone around transit, and also community priority zones, which actually really align with some of our multifamily neighborhoods. The second planning effort was the 2012 regional plan with its focus on town centers. And then third, the neighborhoods that have already been designated as areas where multifamily is an allowed use and where we already have quite a bit of affordable housing. So most of those areas already aligned with the existing bonus unit boundary, but there were a couple of places where they weren't fully in alignment. So we wanted to look at bringing those three things into conformance with the bonus unit boundary. So then just to show you, oh, actually, Tracy, could you advance this? Or actually, hang on. Yeah, the backup one, if you can. So this boundary is the existing bonus unit boundary. It is the 1/2 mile buffer from existing transit routes. Then we wanted to look at adding the boundary, a 1/2 mile walking distance boundary to town centers. So now, Tracy, if you could click. So that adds, you know, that pretty much aligns with the 1/2 mile buffer to transit, but it does add a little bit of area. In particular, it adds the Myers area plan or the Myers Town Center. And then if you forward to the next layer, so these are the neighborhoods that are designated as multifamily areas where multifamily development is allowed. And so again, it pretty much lines up with the existing boundary, but there were a few locations that jutted out, and some of those included the community priority zones that were identified in the regional transportation plan. So the last layer shows the proposed boundary. If you click one more, thank you. So this added about 15% to the overall geography of the bonus unit boundary. And TRPA staff has done the initial environmental analysis on this change, and the expanded boundary corresponds very closely to the low VMT, the low vehicle miles traveled traffic analysis zones. So incentivizing development in this area would be consistent with achieving the new VMT threshold. Next slide, please. So the next change is to allow non-conforming tourist density to be used on site for residential development. So one of the issues that we've heard is that conversion of tourist or redevelopment of tourists to residential is actually disincentivized. So we have quite a few older motels, many of which are getting quite run down, and many of which have higher densities that are currently allowed. And they were built maybe in the 60s and 70s before our regional plan was approved. So the regional plan envisioned redevelopment of these older properties potentially into mixed use or residential. However, when these properties come forward for redevelopment projects, we're finding that they are not redeveloping as residential. They're staying as tourist units. And so I want to explain how the current system works and then what we're proposing. So next slide, please. So in the staff report, we provided a real life example of an existing hotel in the State Line area that was built prior to approval of the regional plan. They wanted to redevelop to residential, and they had 17 tourist units on a little less than a third of an acre. So they were a little over the current allowable tourist densities. Our current code would allow all of these tourist units to be grandfathered in if they are redeveloped as new tourist units. But if they would be redeveloped as residential units, they would have to comply with the existing residential densities for that area. And our maximum residential densities are much lower than allowable tourist densities and lower than some of these non-conforming tourist densities. So in this particular case, this property would only have been able to build 6 residential units on site if they redeveloped to residential. You know, there's conversions, they could convert these units to development rights and bank them on site and potentially transfer them off the site. But for what they could do on site, their densities were limited for residential. So that's how our existing code works. And then what we're proposing, if you can go to the next slide, please, Tracy. The proposed code change would allow converted non-conforming tourist density to be used for multifamily redevelopment on site, as long as multifamily is an allowed use in that location. So the proposed code would allow the 17 units to remain on site and be redeveloped as tourist or as residential. And again, any extra units that resulted from the actual conversion could be banked on site or transferred off, but 17 residential units could be built on the site. So again, for this, this recommendation, we've completed the initial environmental analysis as well, and we've identified that because conversion of tourist units to residential was already evaluated through the Development Rights Strategic Initiative, and because these conversions will only be allowed where multifamily is an allowed use, and hence within that proposed bonus unit boundary where we want to incentivize additional residential development, that this change will support achieving the VMT threshold. And again, it is within our growth caps. It doesn't change the overall amount of allowed growth in the region. So next slide, please. So the third recommendation is related to accessory dwelling units. So this proposal harkens back to what I was mentioning before, this theme of looking at ways to make it easier to build a diversity of housing types, including housing types that are the right size to be more affordable for our local residents and our local workforce, and trying to remove some of those barriers that impede these smaller or workforce-oriented units. So accessory dwelling units, also known as ADUs, I'm sure most of you know what those are, but the definition here is that they're a housing unit that is accessory to a larger existing home. They can be detached from the main home, they can be attached, or they can also be repurposed existing space, such as locking off a bedroom and adding an exterior entrance. So this type of repurposed space is also known as a junior ADU. So our existing code related to ADUs does not go very far in encouraging this workforce housing type. So right now our code only allows ADUs on parcels of greater than 1 acre, and parcels that meet that criterion are fairly limited in number. Also, on average, parcel sizes tend to be smaller the closer they are to town centers, and average parcel size increases as they get further away from town centers and transit. So we want to shift the focus and the incentives overall to allowing this workforce housing type more widely, and then having ADUs help us support our goals of walkable town centers and walkable neighborhoods. And this proposal, combined with the incentives built into the bonus unit boundary, does that. So next slide, please. So these are our current ADU regulations. So currently our code allows ADUs only on parcels of 1 acre or greater. Where they are allowed, we only allow one per parcel. And then because ADUs as an accessory use is the exception, not the rule, because it's only allowed on certain parcels, they require special noticing to neighbors, unlike other expansions of single family uses. And next slide. So based on the general consensus of the working group, we are proposing to lift the 1 acre parcel size limit, so ADUs would be allowed on any residential parcel. We're also proposing to allow up to 2 ADUs per parcel. This would allow a homeowner to build one junior ADU, that repurposed existing space, and one detached ADU or attached ADU elsewhere on the with the house. And then because ADUs are an allowed use on all residential parcels, just like other accessory uses, they wouldn't require special noticing to neighbors. So next slide, please. So that was the summary of the proposed changes to TRPA's regulations. Local jurisdictions can make their codes more restrictive. Also, the actual design of ADUs needs to comply with local design standards. So I just want to go over what some of the existing local regulations are that are in place that affect ADUs. So right now, Douglas County and Washoe County have codified TRPA's restriction to parcels of greater than 1 acre. So unless and until those counties change their code, ADUs this code proposal would not change where ADUs are allowed from what they are allowed today in Washoe County and Douglas County. There's some opportunities to look at revising that through the area plan process. On the California side, each California jurisdiction has passed or is in the process of passing their own ADU regulations that reflect California law. So based on this, in the California counties, City of Southlake counties and jurisdictions, the city, El Dorado County and Placer County, ADUs would be allowed on all residential parcels, and there would not be rentals of less than 30 days allowed. And then as you'll note in your packet, we are bringing forward the area plan amendments for the area plans in the city and El Dorado County that would be needed for those jurisdictions to implement their own ADU codes in those area plans. So that's part of this packet. And we're working on the environmental analysis for this proposal, in particular modeling this in our transportation model. And we expect to see that this proposal will be consistent with our VMT threshold because it emphasizes development and incentivizes development within the bonus unit boundary and provides more workforce housing that would reduce commuting into the basin. If we find that it's increasing VMT, though, we may modify the proposal in the version that we bring back. Next slide, please. So I want to summarize some of the working group feedback that we weren't able to incorporate into this near-term recommendation. Most of the feedback is fully incorporated, but there were some additional comments that I want to go over. So in general, there was strong support for moving this forward. However, many working group members wanted the proposal to go further. And there were two key areas where they thought the proposal should do more, and that was related to coverage and development rights. So this proposal does not introduce any changes to our coverage or development rights system related to ADUs. So ADUs, if someone wants to build a detached ADU, they need to have enough coverage to do that. And they also need to get a full development right. So either a bonus unit, if they're eligible for a bonus unit, or a residential unit of use, or an allocation paired with a potential unit of use. So related to coverage, about two-thirds of residential parcels do not have enough coverage to build a detached ADU. So there were some concerns that our coverage regulations wouldn't, they wouldn't do enough to encourage accessory dwelling units. And some ideas came up about potentially looking at areas where there's area-wide BMPs in place. Could we relax the coverage standards for ADUs in those locations, or maybe look at some incentives, coverage incentives for ADUs that are similar to the coverage incentives for affordable housing that we allow in town centers. And then related to development rights, one of the concerns that came up is that ADUs are generally small. They're often a one bedroom or a studio, or usually maximum of two bedrooms. And that's and there was a concern that they shouldn't use up a whole bonus unit or a development right. Bonus units or development rights are often used for larger units, like a three bedroom or larger. So there is some precedent for having different development right ratios. For instance, the conversion ratios that we established in the Development Rights Strategic Initiative, they apply you can have a 1.5 multifamily units to one tourist unit or one single family unit. So there's a recognition that the impact of multifamily is often smaller. So potentially we could look at doing something similar for accessory dwelling units. So we did hear that input, and we appreciate that there may need to be more incentives to really get ADUs on the ground as a source of workforce housing. But we needed more time to look more intensively at those other incentives. So coverage incentives for workforce housing was already identified as part of the medium-term action set. So we are planning to look at coverage incentives related to ADUs as part of that action, and that'll be the next set of actions that the working group looks at. And then because of working group feedback, we plan to look at development rights related to ADUs in the permitting action, which is also part of that matrix. So next slide, please. So the next steps for this package, this month we're doing informational hearings at the APC and Regional Plan Implementation Committee. And then this afternoon we are bringing this item also to the Local Government and Housing Committee and asking them for direction to move the package forward to RPIC for a recommendation for approval. And then once we anticipate that we will be able to bring the amendments back for formal recommendations for approval, hopefully by July, if not then by August or this summer. And then again, I just wanted to mention the draft code language that we put in your packet is still a draft. We definitely would like to get your feedback on that today if you have input, or send it to us over the next few weeks. And we have already received some edits from the city on the draft code amendment. So when we come back for a formal recommendation, there will likely be changes to the actual draft code language. So thank you very much for your attention. The housing team is here on the line. Alyssa Bettinger, John Hester, and John Marshall, myself, are all available for questions. And I know some of the working group members may want to answer questions or chime in as well.
Thanks, Karen. Yeah, great presentation. Good summary of, kind of an extensive public and agency process that we've gone through with the working group. So thank you very much for summarizing that and for bringing this item to us. Great to see progress. And let's see, I want to go now to APC members for questions, comments for Karen or any of the other working group members. Go ahead and put your name in the chat or unmute and speak up.
Thank you, Jason.
Mr. Chairman, this is Jason Drew. Karen, thank you for the presentation. Very helpful. This is certainly a really critical issue for our community and most of the communities in the surrounding areas. So I appreciate the thoughtful effort that's going into this. I had a couple of questions. The first one is related to the example you were giving about the tourist site where it's a hotel with 17 TAUs on it, and if it was converted to a hotel or some other kind of lodging facility, it would get the 17 again. And then, but under current code, it would only be allowed 6 residential units. But under this code amendment that's being considered, it would be allowed to have up to 17 residential units. And you mentioned that assuming that residential is an allowed use on that site, have you guys had a chance to look at how many of those potential locations exist and how many of them may run into not having the appropriate land use designation to switch to residential?
So most of the tourist most places where tourist is currently an allowed use, residential is also an allowed use. So in most places, this or multifamily is an allowed use. So in most places, in most of the examples that have come forward, multifamily is an allowed use. There's a few places where there's tourist units potentially out like by Camp Richardson or sometimes near ski resorts where the multifamily specifically is not an allowed use. Employee housing might be an allowed use, but multifamily isn't. So it wouldn't be allowed in those places, but in most places it is. We haven't done a specific analysis on every property, but in general, tourist units are in areas where multifamily is allowed.
Okay, great, thank you. The reason that I bring that up is it may be worth looking at all of those potential sites and the ones where it isn't viable to make that change, to work with the local jurisdictions to have that change made as a part of this effort. Because as many of you know, when a private entity or even a partnership comes forward to make that change, they can often run into a lot of hurdles in trying to get that land use designation changed. So if that's something we really want to encourage, I would say that we would try to find all of those sites where multifamily is not allowed and try and have that conversion happen from an agency supported perspective rather than leaving it for a developer partner to do that work. Just something to consider to try and make that more fluid. So thanks on that. The second question I had was related to the ADUs. And you answered part of my question related to coverage, but I also had a question related to height. A lot of times, if it's an attached ADU, most of the architectural structures, given the way that houses have been built since the first regional plan in the basin, they're often above a garage. And so height comes into play, especially if you have any kind of sloped parcel. So is that something you're looking at as well, is trying to incentivize both coverage and then are you also looking at height? Because I know sometimes that can start to play into the issue of if you can get an ADU on top of the garage.
Yeah, that's a great question. Height and coverage tend to come up together along with density as sort of a like set of site constraints that sometimes are a challenge for developers with sparse housing. So height has definitely come up, and that is one of the issues that we're planning to look at in those medium-term items. The medium-term action items. So along with coverage, we do want to look at height as well and whether there are potentially some transition zones near our town centers where we might want to look at potentially some additional height for workforce housing.
Great, thank you. And again, I appreciate your leadership on this and all the members of the committee, both on the staff and the APC side. I appreciate all that you guys are doing. This is so desperately needed in our community. And I hope this kind of discussions and these kinds of outreach efforts will help people better understand what we're trying to achieve here, and we'll have less to work against when we actually start getting these on the ground. So thanks again. Great presentation.
Thanks, Jason. Other APC members?
Yes, hi, this is Susan. Karen, thanks for all of the good work that you're doing. This is really important work. Just to kind of piggyback on the last statement about the ADUs, you've talked about coverage and height. Will there be any changes related to setbacks?
Setbacks are dealt with at the local level. So the local jurisdictions have made some changes to setbacks in when they've approved their own local regulations, like Placer County and the city. But TRPA generally doesn't have setback regulations unless it's in the shore zone.
Okay, great. Thank
Not
you.
Do anything with setbacks.
Okay, another question. I spent some time looking at, on page 27, the boundary map, looking at the blow up of the map. And there's an interesting little finger that projects on the east side of Tahoe Keys. And I'm kind of, I know that there are townhouses, condos there, but I'm kind of wondering why that section has been included.
Hmm. I might need to get back to you on that, and I would be happy to. It seems like it is. So okay, here, let me open up the map really fast. So that's new. That wasn't part of the existing boundary.
It certainly doesn't seem to meet the requirement of being the half mile from the transit zones.
And that it's not, so it's new. It's part of the new boundary that we're proposing. And it wasn't there before.
Karen, I think it was, this is John Marshall. I think it was as a result of the last, the steps that you went through, and I can't remember which is the last one that you did.
Yeah, it's the multifamily.
But yeah, I would suggest that maybe we get back.
Yeah.
Okay, that's fine, but I just wanted to try to understand why that was included. And then my final question is really just more to educate me. On page 37, under 31.46, they talk about July 1st, 1987 being selected as the legal establishment date. And I'm just curious as to why that's the legal establishment date. And again, you can get back to me if.
Do I take that one, Karen?
Well, I was thinking that you might be better to answer that question.
That's the date of the adoption of the 1987 regional plan.
Okay, thank you. Thank you.
And just looking at that section in the Tahoe Keys area, it looks like it was part of the multifamily zoning. So I'll double check and make sure, but it seems like that's potentially that area allows multifamily. So that's why it would be included in the boundary.
Okay, thank you very much. I appreciate your time.
Thank you, Susan.
Let's see. Mr. Chair, are you coming from Usher County?
Yes, go ahead.
I thank you. As a member of the working group, I'd like to vouch that this was a very good representation of our discussions and our conclusions. So thank you, Karen. Karen did a good job getting us all here. There was an awful lot to talk about over the last many months. I'd like to make sure we all recognize, though, that this, as we move through and hopefully these things will get adopted, it's just one step. This is going to continue to be an issue for us. Most everybody here has prefaced their comments by recognizing what an important issue it is, what a difficult issue it is in our communities, and we all know we need to do something. And this is a great step, and we'll see, you know, where it gets us. But this, we can't feel like we're done. We're going to have to continue probably forever having discussions about innovative ways we can try and get housing that's more affordable to people that work there to be possible. So this is a great job. We should be proud of where we're going with this, but we need to recognize that it's not the end, and new ideas for housing are always welcome. It's a discussion that's always welcome if you think you have an idea or if you have an issue you need to bring up, because it's just something that's going to be with us. So thank you, Karen, for getting us here, and I look forward to our future discussions.
Thanks, Eric. I agree. We'll be talking about this indefinitely, probably. Ms. Simon asked a question in the chat, and I just want to read it, and Mr. Gavon responded. Karen, you did touch on this a little, but she asks, might these recommendations, RE ADUs, give an incentive to create STRs or short-term rentals rather than workforce housing? And Eric did respond, ADU should be restricted to monthly rentals or more, and so they do not include short-term rentals. So that is correct.
Okay, I just didn't see a way to raise my hand. This is Judy Simon. So that was a good representation of my question and answer. Thank you.
And yeah, I could give a little more detail. The code recommendation that we've brought forward does not specifically state that ADUs cannot be used as short-term rentals. Based on the work that the governing board did before with allowing local jurisdictions to have short-term rentals if they comply with neighborhood compatibility requirements, we're continuing to leave that to the local jurisdictions. If someone does want to use an ADU as an STR for shorter than 30 days, they would need to get a full development right, just like they would for any other single family house. And so development rights, you know, there's barriers associated with that, like there's a cost associated with it. But then in addition to that, there are the other restrictions that the local jurisdictions have placed on short-term rentals. So the California jurisdictions, as I understand, in accordance with the California law, have all placed a restriction that that ADUs cannot be used as short-term rentals. And then if someone receives a bonus unit from TRPA to build an ADU, then it cannot be used as a short-term rental.
Okay, I'm from Washoe County, and I know that those regulations for short-term rentals have been adopted, but just and within the last couple of months. So thank you.
Just to provide a little more, this is John Marshall. In the Nevada side of the basin, ADUs right now can't be put on properties less than an acre. So there's going to be no effective change on the Nevada side as a result of these amendments. So whatever could happen to ADUs, which historically have been called secondary residences in TRPA's language, but for secondary residences on the Nevada side, there's no new rules. There will be, so it's up to the local jurisdictions on the Nevada side is whether to reduce the acreage allowances. But I don't believe that there is any specific rules on the Nevada side regarding ADUs to be used exclusively for housing, long-term housing, and not for vacation rentals or STRs.
Thank you.
Brendan, if I may follow up, this is an area that was one of the questions that I had as well. So following on that discussion, is policing of that issue handled by the local jurisdictions? If someone, you know, sort of basically pulls a bait and switch or changes their mind after they've rented it for workforce housing for 5 years and they're like, yeah, I can make more money as a short-term rental. How is that actually monitored and policed to make sure that people are, you know, following their deed restrictions or things like that?
If they receive a deed restriction from TRPA in exchange for a bonus unit, TRPA has a compliance and monitoring enforcement program for those deed restrictions. If it's in an accessory dwelling unit that doesn't receive a bonus unit, then that is up to the local jurisdictions, and they have been enforcing short-term rental compliance through their own ordinances. And I believe many of the local jurisdictions are using host compliance, an outside firm, to track and make sure that those units are complying with the short-term rental ordinances.
The Jennifer, there's a motivation from the local governments for TOT and other collections to get STRs under permit. So they are monitoring STRs to make certain that they have a permit. They can't get a permit if they're an ADU on the California side, or if they are as a result of a bonus unit. So we're kind of piggybacking on the enforcement, I think really kind of on both sides too, as to, you know, the local jurisdiction self-interest in that TOT collection to get the STRs under permit. And so there's a bit of a synergy there with the enforcement opportunities.
Thank you both. That's very helpful to understand how the big picture rolls together. Brendan, since I got the floor, if you don't mind, I'll just kind of keep going with my other questions. You good? All right. I had a couple of other items that were more related, related to vehicles. So between now and the next hearing, I am interested in what staff does with their evaluation on this potential to increase VMT or not. So that's something that I look forward to seeing in the next staff packet when this comes back to us. So thanks for mentioning that you're going to be looking at that. Another thing that I would be concerned about with related to vehicles is parking for the ADUs to ensure that we're not creating on-street parking or soft surface parking that could create other, you know, runoff, stormwater, water quality issues. And I don't know that I've heard anything about that particular issue in this package. So if there could be some discussion about that, you know, even though these units are intended to be in sort of the walkable areas, I think we still have to assume that the residents will have a vehicle, you know, to get around further distances. So I'm interested in that. As well as, it probably gets to your VMT evaluation, but just impacts on neighborhood traffic. You know, I tried to imagine if, you know, a number of homes in my neighborhood all of a sudden had ADUs in their backyards, what that would do to, you know, the traffic on my cul-de-sac or, you know, that sort of thing. And it would be substantial. I'm curious again to see how that evaluation plays out just on overall potential to impact neighborhood traffic. I know at the last meeting we talked about the VMT meeting, we talked about, you know, emergency egress and those sorts of things. So those will all kind of start to roll together. I have one other question, but those are sort of topical together if you wanted to provide any thoughts.
Yeah, so I can definitely provide more information on those in the next presentation and the next staff report as well. In general, there have been quite a few studies on the amount of vehicles that ADU dwellers arrive with. And overall, the vast majority have one car because these are small units, they're studios or one bedrooms or a two bedroom at the largest. And then the other, there was one study from Portland that showed that 70% of people who lived in ADUs had one car, and the remaining 30% either had zero cars or two cars. So, and that is really because they are intended to be in walkable areas and for, you know, people who are trying to reduce their costs, but we can bring some of that background data as well. And then parking is regulated at the local level, so the local jurisdictions are the ones that specify the parking requirements. And then related to evacuation, that is a really important issue too, and comes up a lot related to any of this new development that we're working on with the regional plan and implementing our regional plan. So that again is the purview of local law enforcement, and local law enforcement communicates those plans to residents of how to evacuate. But we have actually been reaching out to law enforcement and Tahoe Douglas Fire, and we'd like to bring back a presentation to the governing board, potentially on evacuation issues as a whole, because it's so critical right now. And if there's interest from the APC, we could potentially bring that presentation to the APC as well. And then, yeah, for the neighborhood traffic, yeah, whenever we're looking at adding new units, it's always this kind of balance between we're trying to put in more units close to transit so people can, and close to town center so people can walk and not need a car. But whenever we start adding units, there's a concern about traffic. So again, these proposals are within the overall growth that was planned for the region. And our task now is really to look at tools to continue to incentivize getting that growth close to transit and close to walkable areas so that people really don't need a vehicle. And yeah, we'd be happy to bring some more information related to that in the next presentation too, if there's to just clarify the impacts that come out of our analysis.
Thank you. That's all really helpful, and I applaud the effort to try to bring people back to the areas where they can, you know, work and live in close proximity. So I think it's healthy on a number of reasons, healthy for the residents and healthy for the basin. So thank you for doing the work. the last question I had was just about the recommendation to remove the notice requirements for mm-hmm. construction of ADUs. And I'm wondering what outreach has been done to property owners about this proposal, I know you have your normal outreach for these meetings with public notices and things like that, but are you seeing through these various working group meetings and things like that that the average resident is aware of what is going on, or is there going to be potentially be a backlash of folks that are like, I didn't know that we could, you know, my neighbors on both sides could build an ADU and I hate it, you know? So I'm just curious about that aspect.
Yeah, so we have been slowly building our mailing list of people who are interested in housing. So whenever someone contacts us, we add them to the mailing list and encourage them to attend the working group meetings. We did also hold a specific webinar related to accessory dwelling units, which we advertised in the newspapers and invited people to attend and noted that, you know, we're looking at accessory dwelling units as a workforce housing type. We had about 100 people attend that webinar. So that was good. So, and then we've put some articles in Tahoe In Depth and in the newspaper. So there has been some general communication about it. What we heard specifically from the working group related to the noticing, and this came up primarily from planning staff, was that when uses are sometimes an exception to the rule, like if it's a special use, then they should require noticing, but if it's allowed and allowed use, then it wouldn't need noticing. So I agree, this is the time to get the word out, because this is the opportunity that people have to provide input on that, so we can continue to do outreach. But that is the outreach that we've done so far.
Oh, that sounds good. And to have 100 people from the public turnout to a webinar sounds like actually really great turnout. So thank you for those efforts and whatever you'll do between now and formal, seeking formal approval. So thank you. That's it, Brendan. Thanks.
Thanks, Jennifer. Ellery Stoller has some comments.
Hi, thanks, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Karen, for the presentation. I just found it fascinating. And I also really appreciate all the work that you and the working group are doing to tackle this topic. I know how important it is for the Tahoe Basin. Jennifer actually asked two of my questions, so I only have one question remaining, and that's related to coverage. The Nevada Division of State Lands, my agency, we run the Nevada Land Bank Program. And so I know that property owners have the ability to sell their potential coverage. They have the ability to sell restored hard and soft coverage, any coverage that they're not utilizing, they have that ability to sell and kind of generate income for themselves that way. Once that coverage is sold to the land bank, we can either retire it, just take it off the books entirely, or we can sell it to another property owner who has the ability to use that coverage, but only to a property owner whose soil type is less sensitive than the originating coverage. So in that way, programmatically, we're kind of systematically transferring the coverage from more environmentally sensitive areas to less environmentally sensitive areas. And so I'm kind of envisioning with this change that's being proposed, there may be the opportunity with the ADUs for people to maximize their coverage on site. It may be in their financial interest to develop an ADU rather than to sell their coverage. And then I'm wondering if then maybe there's a consequence with that happening, if we lose the opportunity to transfer that coverage from the more environmentally sensitive areas to the less environmentally sensitive areas, if that makes sense. So I just wanted to bring that to the working group's attention to see if that has been contemplated at all, or maybe it would be worth analyzing or looking into a little bit deeper. Thanks, Mr. Chair. That's my only comment.
Thanks.
Thanks, Ellery. Crystal Jacobson from Placer County has some comments for you, Karen. Go ahead, Crystal.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I really am excited about these changes and really want to thank staff for this work and the opportunity for Placer County to collaborate on the Tahoe Living Working Group. I would say we really appreciate the effort. I think these changes are innovative and definitely will help support local and regional goals around housing affordability. So thank you. I do want to point out, I really like the changes related to the non-conforming tourist density piece. I think that's a good creative approach to encourage redevelopment of our older, you know, motel and hotels that we've got here in Placer. I also just want to point out really great work on the ADU. As someone who has lived in ADUs in the past, more than one, I can say that I really do think that they by design provide affordable housing options, but they also fit really well within the character of existing neighborhoods. So I fully support allowing ADUs on all parcels, allowing, you know, the ADU and the junior unit, and removing the noticing requirements. You know, ultimately, when they are built, I do believe that they fit well into the neighborhood, but also provide that affordable housing option. And then really, they, you know, this, I think the work that you've done on ADUs here is very much in alignment with the California state regs and the goals there. So we really do look forward to even more alignment with state goals in terms of removing barriers and limiting costs. I look forward to what comes, you know, what will come in the future regarding applications and coverage, or even just discussions on that. And then finally, I did want to acknowledge some of the written public comment that came in regarding the ADU regs. There were some comments about the process being confusing and then some comments about cost estimates. I appreciate those comments. I will say we do here at Placer, you know, we get comments like that from our customers and frankly, even some of our staff, because TRPA's regulations are a little different than ours. Our process is a little different. So people get confused. So I just want to point out that we, you know, Placer has established what we call an ADU resource center. So we have dedicated staff to kind of help folks navigate through the permit process. And just point out that we are working right now currently to provide some more clarity on the ADU process and really help folks navigate through that, through both Placer and TRPA. We also have cost estimates. So we have a fee estimator. And so I just wanted to point that out. We've got a website that's dedicated to that. It's a good way to, you know, really encourage the construction of ADUs, understanding that they do provide that affordable housing option. So anyway, just I wanted to say thank you. I forget the name of the person that submitted those comments, but I thought they were good. And I just wanted to acknowledge those. So that's all I have, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Thanks, Crystal. Great comments. I agree. I'll ask about the public comment that was written in a moment, but I'm going to first go to Hillary Roverud, who has some questions for you, Karen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Karen, thanks for the presentation and all your work on this. We're really excited to see some movement going forward to allow ADUs in our residential neighborhoods. I know you've reached out, really appreciate the opportunity to look at the code amendments, and we're still having some discussions about some of the details there. Really appreciate the staff's effort in your analysis on expanding the bonus unit boundary to be consistent with other policy direction. I think that's going to be really helpful, as well as the clarifications on the conversion and retaining the density. So thank you very much for including that in the efforts, as well as the accessory dwelling units. I know we're still discussing the changes to the tourist core and the Tahoe Valley area plan in order to incorporate allowing ADUs in those areas. And, you know, so we can get into that another time, but wanted to just let you know that, you know, our priority right now is really trying to allow for ADUs in our residential zones, which are outside of our area plans. Not that we don't want to incorporate them into the area plans as well. It's something we certainly have on our work plan and we'll be moving forward with. A couple of things I just wanted to bring up, maybe for discussion even with the rest of the commission to get their input. The code changes to that would eliminate the secondary unit or secondary residence, I guess it's called, in the current TRPA code. Wanted to kind of talk about that a little bit more. The way it's defined right now, a secondary residence could apply to not only residential primary uses, but also commercial, tourist accommodation, public service, and recreation. And I want to make sure that we don't eliminate the opportunity to develop a secondary residence in those other types of land uses. You know, the city adopted an ADU, accessory dwelling unit ordinance, but it is specific to residential areas. And we would like to see, continue to see secondary residences be able to be constructed where there's these other primary land uses and not be subject to the same standards that our ADU ordinance has, because those were really specific to neighborhoods and compatibility with the neighborhoods. And so there's kind of, you know, different issues there. So I don't know if that's something that would affect the other jurisdictions as well. I know for us, we really rely on the TRPA code definitions for allowable uses. So just wanted to bring that up for discussion or maybe something to look at before the next presentation. And yeah, that's all I had. And, you know, just the discussion about vacation rentals in the city of South Lake Tahoe. Vacation rentals are not allowed in the residential areas. The existing ones are being phased out over the course of this year, and they will be eliminated by the end of 2021. So that restriction would also apply to accessory dwelling units.
Thanks, Hillary. Karen, do you want to respond to anything?
Yeah, thanks. I really appreciate that. I do think we need to take another look at the wording that we've proposed in the draft code related to accessory dwelling units for residential and other accessory or secondary units and make sure that we're capturing needs. Because, right, we don't want to eliminate secondary, or we don't want to eliminate units accessory to commercial or tourists. So we'll work with you on that.
Thanks. Sorry, my leg keeps going off. Crystal wanted to chime in on that from Placer's perspective. Do you want to jump in, Crystal?
Yeah, thank you. I would just say that, you know, for Placer, we have already made our changes in our code to go from secondary unit to accessory dwelling unit. We also have a definition that in our code that speaks to, it's a caretaker unit. So we already, and the caretakers are for those commercial industrial type uses. But I think that I understand where, you know, Hillary's coming from in terms of revisiting that definition and maybe providing a little bit more flexibility there or clarity, and would support that.
Mr. Chairman?
Steve, yes, go ahead.
Thank you, sir. So for the record, Steve, to share, I wanted to share the concern, highlight the concern that is in the staff report on page 32. And Karen mentioned this, but Mia Kong had talked about, you know, the concern that many of us have that as we do more, which we should be doing to move forward affordable housing, certainly deed restricted, the bonus unit total will continue to dwindle. And the question becomes, if a person is getting a bonus unit for an accessory dwelling unit that is significantly smaller than a normal residential property, is there some ratio that we can create so that we're not using up whole bonus units for an accessory dwelling unit? And I see in the staff report, Karen, that you have that this could be addressed at a future time as we move forward, but I just wanted to highlight that. I know this was attributed to Mia, but I understand there's others who have shared the concern. It's possibly not something that would block us from moving the ball down the field here, but I think it is something that as the bonus units dwindle, it's something we need to grapple with. So I appreciate bringing that up. And just, you know, to highlight, putting on my Tahoe Chamber hat, highlight, you know, how significant the lack of affordable housing is as we try to emerge from the pandemic. And as you drive around any part of the basin, and it's not just Tahoe, but, you know, there's help wanted signs, and the cost of housing is an incredible impediment to people's ability to live here and work here. And a lot of people left and aren't coming back because there's no place for them to live anymore. So I share with my colleagues the good work that's going on and look forward to the working group meeting this afternoon. Thank you.
Thanks, Steve. Mr. Drake, I understand you have a comment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Big thanks to everyone, staff and APC members who participated in this. It's a worthy effort, much needed, and I really like the approach. I'll second the importance of having a pathway for conversion of non-conforming tourist units to multifamily. I've spoken to two people on the North Shore who are owners of old motels and kind of looking at options. And I think this is a huge opportunity and will help to put a dent, however small or large, in our huge workforce housing issue. To the ADU conversation, I think it's that kind of as Steve also brought up, I think it's important that we do make sure that ADUs aren't necessarily going to use up a full bonus unit. They're precious units, and I think, and I'm happy to hear that there's going to be more consideration given to how to apportion those units for different types of housing. And also on the ADU front, I think local jurisdictions are well equipped to manage the finer details of how to address the local concerns, and they're already doing it when it comes to noticing or setbacks or parking and height and things like that. There have always been legitimate concerns about ADUs since the dawn of the ADU idea, but it's an incredibly important equation to solve. And I do I want to point out that I think ADUs not only help to create more housing that could be like workforce housing or housing suitable for the, you know, single person or the couple looking for an affordable place. It also helps to keep residents in Tahoe who are struggling to afford a home or to maybe purchase a home. And I think that's a key consideration, just keeping people who want to be here in the basin here and not having to be faced with the prospect of moving to an more affordable area. And I think the ADU can solve both of those things despite their complexity. So, you know, I also am an employer struggling to retain and attract staff, and housing is the number one concern. I just see over and over again, most of the housing being sold right now is currently in long-term rentals and being converted to just a sale. And so it's a huge issue. I think this is there are major steps being made here. And those are the couple of things I wanted to point out. So thanks everyone for their efforts.
Thanks, Kevin. Any other APC member comments or questions? Okay. I just want to reinforce too, you know, El Dorado County's appreciation for, you know, the bonus unit boundary change. Like you mentioned, Myers is a big addition to that. So we're very appreciative of that change. The non-conforming tourist density is a fantastic change. We are working to adopt the ADU changes into our Myers area plan. And thank you very much for including that in this packet. We really appreciate that. And looking forward to continuing to move this effort forward. So I've been happy to be a part of all of it. And just want to send my appreciation to everyone involved for that. I think we have closed APC member comments. So I'm now going to move to public comment on this item. So again, to participate in the meeting, go to trpa.gov. In the calendar, click on Advisory Planning Commission meeting June 9, 2021. There you'll find a link to the public webinar hosted on GoToWebinar. If any member of the public wishes to address the Advisory Planning Commission at this time, please use the hand-raising function and you'll be unmuted by a TRPA staff member. I'll turn this over to you, Catherine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The first hand we have up is Kathy Julian. Kathy, you are unmuted on my end. If you also unmute on yours, you'll be able to address the committee. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'm an Incline Village resident. And I do thank Karen Fink both for her presentation and also for her answering some of my questions this week. I just want to follow up on the question about how in Washoe County we ensure that any new ADUs do not end up as inventory for STRs. And I understand, I'm fully supportive of the concept of ADUs for workforce housing here in Incline. I think that's a great idea. However, I am concerned that since Washoe County does not have a restriction on 30-day or less AD rentals, that these ADUs could be used as short-term rentals. And I could see the Washoe County changing their code here in Incline through their area plan to be consistent with TRPA. This is what they have been doing recently to ensure consistency. But in doing so, I could also see them not including that very important provision about no rentals less than 30 days. And if that happens, then sadly, we are left with more inventory for STRs, and in a sense, it backfires on us. We don't have the workforce housing in the context of Incline Village in Washoe County. Now, I know you'll say, well, we leave it up to the local jurisdictions, but the incentive here in Washoe County is to maximize tourist taxes, TOT. So there really is a lot of incentive to maximize income from short-term rental, not necessarily the workforce housing. So that's a concern of the citizen here in Incline Village. Again, I'm supportive of this, but I think that the working group needs to be very, very aware that this may not turn out as they had hoped in the context of Washoe County and Incline Village. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your public comment.
Okay, the next hand raised is John Falk. John, you're unmuted and can address the APC.
All right, thank you very much. John Falk, Tallahassee Board of Realtors Legislative Advocate. And I just wanted to recenter on one of the major issues that it's been grappled with at the working group meetings. And that's the whole concept that the ADU as a type of construction is probably the most affordable way to add housing within the basin that will actually provide that workforce housing. So it's critically important that we remove as many barriers as possible. And all of the barriers that we've been looking at in the working group and some of the ones that were reintroduced today as talking points to talk about are important from environmental and traffic and quality of life issues. But equally important is what was said about employee attraction and retention. And so we need these ADUs because to expect someone to utilize their full property for a single standalone affordable unit is difficult to pencil out, if not impossible. It's difficult to do in multifamily situations at present. And I also wanted to reiterate that in California law, and California has been very aggressive in state law regarding ADUs and making sure that local government doesn't provide unnecessary impediments or barriers to ADU construction. And so while it is true that new, and I emphasize new, ADUs cannot be utilized for short-term rentals, 30 days, under 30 days. And so any new construction statewide in California is excluded from the STR market, which does mean that the important mix we have of STRs and long-term ADUs is going to be hypercritical over the long haul, because the tourism-based economy that supports this region by and large also requires those STRs, not only for the revenue to cities and counties, but also more importantly to the revenue it provides to businesses that cannot be backfilled at present by the number of hotel and motel rooms that are available, much less desirable. So it seems that we need to make sure that while California law doesn't allow new ADUs to be used as STRs, that it's recognized that STRs have a valuable place in the economic picture for the basin. And in Nevada, it truly is related to local jurisdictions, unless within the basin, if they apply for a bonus unit, then it would trigger the less than 30 day no use. But outside of that, it would be up to Washoe County, Douglas County, ... to create a local ordinance that would either comply or not. Thank you.
Thank you, John.
Patrick Taylor, you're unmuted on my end. If you unmute yourself, you can address the commission.
Hi, I'm Patrick Taylor. I'm with Alpine Corporation, and our company is a workforce housing developer in the located in the basin. We develop all around the basin, both the North Shore and South Shore. We currently have three projects. One of the things that we run into often in our planning of our new projects is the height restrictions when we're in outside of a town center, and typically we're like a quarter mile outside of a town center. So if that's something that you can look into when you're working on your new regulations, new changes to the code, that would really be helpful to us, because that makes a big difference to us and how many units is what we've ran into we can build into our projects really can impact the number of units in any particular project just by that height restriction alone. So I just wanted to throw that in there, as well as that was a great presentation, Karen. Another thing I wanted to throw out there is that When we take our pro formas out to the market to investors and or when they're reviewed by potential lenders, a constant comment that comes back to us is the expenses that we have to pay to both TRPA and the counties for the fees, how much larger they are into other jurisdictions around the country. So I just want to make you aware of that. So if there's a way to bring those fees down for workforce housing, it should be something that should be put on the radar. That's all I have.
Thank you, Patrick, for participating in your comments. We really appreciate it.
Chase Janbren, you're unmuted on my end. To unmute, you can address the EPC. Thank you.
Hi, Chairman Ferry and APC members. I'm Chase Janbren, Program Manager for the Thalo Prosperity Center, and I'm an active member of the Living Working Group. I want to start out by thanking you and TRPA staff for staying so focused on addressing the housing crisis in the basin in general, and in this case, by supporting the recommendations brought forth by the Living Working Group. I want to give Karen kudos for an excellent presentation, and I also like to echo Eric's comments that this is just a starting point. And this will absolutely not solve the housing crisis. Simply allowing ADUs does not mean that everyone's going to install an ADU. And we can see this based on the small number of new ADUs in Placer County and Truckee. So the fear of opening the floodgates, I think, is something that we don't need to worry about. I'm sure you've seen the headlines about Tahoe being one big Zoom town. And as mountain towns across the state and country struggle to ensure that their local workforce stays local and that local businesses can find and hire the local employees they need, the recommendations presented today are small but important steps to improve the housing affordability in the basin. There's a critical need for workforce housing here. I really think it's truly become a crisis, and we need to find ways to allow new, quote, affordable by design housing to be built, not just the large projects, but these smaller affordable by design projects like ADUs that the local workforce can afford to live in. And simply allowing an easier path for ADUs to be built could be a lifesaver for many of the working class individuals in our community, and therefore a lifeline to the very businesses that employ them. These are not big or radical suggestions or ideas. These are quite minimal and basic recommendations to allow for a little increased flexibility for allowing accessory dwelling units and allowing non-conforming tourist density to be used for residential projects. You know, think of course the hotel conversions to workforce or multifamily housing, and modifying the residential bonus unit boundary to reduce sprawl and improve upon your own town center priorities. As one of the regional conveners on housing in Lake Tahoe, the Tahoe Prosperity Center strongly supports these recommendations, and we applaud the TRPA for listening to the recommendations of the Living Working Group, how you're staying focused on creative solutions and by continuing to remove barriers. So again, affordable by design homes can be built quickly. So thank you again for your time today and keep up the great work.
Thanks, Chase.
Mr. Chair, there are no other hands raised to make a comment on this item.
All right, thank you very much, Catherine. Any final comments from APC members? Can I just ask a question about the written comment that we received? Does TRPA respond to written comments, or how do we let that individual know that we received their comment?
Brendan, we did email the commenter to let them know the comment was received and had been distributed to all members of the APC.
Okay, great. Thank you, Tracy. Just wanted to make sure we've closed the loop on that. So Karen, I know this is an informational item, but do I understand that you do need a motion from us to move this forward?
I believe we can take a motion to the motion that is up there to just continue the process forward and bring this back to you with the final draft code and the environmental analysis. So yes,
okay, great. Any APC member wish to entertain that motion?
This is Crystal Jacobson. I would make a motion A motion to recommend staff to finalize the basic. So for whatever reason, I'm not seeing the full language on my screen, but is it the basic package?
Basic housing package.
Housing yep. package, I'm sorry. And move the package forward for RPIC, APC, and governing board consideration for adoption with consideration of the comments brought up by City of South Lake Tahoe today.
Thank you, Crystal. Do I hear
a second? That motion, Brendan.
Yep. Thanks, Jennifer. Great. Okay, we have a motion and a second. Tracy, could you please do a roll call vote for us?
Ms. Chandler?
Yes.
Mr. Drake?
Yes.
Mr. Booth?
Yes.
Mr. Olling?
Aye.
Ms. Ferris?
I believe she signed off, Tracy.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Hill?
Yes.
Ms. Carr?
Yes.
Ms. Jacobson?
Yes.
Mr. Drew?
Yes.
Ms. Roverud?
Yes.
Ms. Simon?
Yes.
Ms. Stala?
Aye.
Mr. Teixeira?
Yes.
Mr. Young?
Yes.
And Mr. Ferry?
Aye.
Mr. Chair, that motion passes.
Thank you, Tracy. And thanks again, Karen, for coming to us. We'll see you, I guess, in July or August for the formal recommendation.
Sounds good. Thank you, everyone.
Have a good rest of the day. Okay, thank you all for participating in that. I'll now move us on to item 6B, which is the issuance of final 2019 threshold evaluation. The TRPA staff report can be found on page 57 of your packet. And I'm going to again turn this over to Mr. Ken Caseman with TRPA to present on this item. Hi, Ken.
Hi, Mr. Chair, members of the commission, we're back again. We presented just last month on the draft evaluation, and we're here again just to bring the final and bring a recommendation for final issuance of the threshold evaluation to the governing board this month. I'll give a quick recap of the evaluation, but you know, first and foremost, we received very little public comment on the evaluation on the draft. And so really there's no substantive changes that have been made. We did post a summary presentation and a quick story map that are available on the threshold dashboard under the evaluations menu. But essentially the results are as we presented last time. So again, you know, this is the seventh comprehensive evaluation that we've done. And like the previous six, the 2019 evaluation showed that we're making incremental progress in achieving our goals. We did have, you know, some slight tabulation changes from the draft to final that were made actually before the dashboard itself was published, but between the staff reports and the final evaluation. So you'll see the change here that 79% of our standards were evaluated in attainment. That's compared to the 80% that we presented last month. But you know, again, we're continuing to see incremental progress towards achieving our goals, and that the evaluation is continuing to call out some areas that we need to look at, and particularly the areas where we're seeing climate change affect, in particular, air quality and water quality. So next slide, please. We'll see here the 79% of our standards were evaluated, and in the final evaluation, 112 of the standards, of the 146 standards were evaluated, which is 77%. And again, that's up quite significantly from the 68% of our standards that were evaluated in 2015. Next slide, please. This is just a quick summary of the attainment changes. And as we talked about last time, the vast majority of our standards really didn't change in terms of their attainment calls, whether they're in attainment or out of attainment. About 85% of the standards stayed in whatever category they were in before. We did have 7 standards that moved from non-attainment into attainment. And again, we called out most of these in the presentation last month. And there was 1 standard that moved out of attainment that was previously in attainment in 2015, and that was the Tahoe Yellowcrest standard that, again, we discussed last month. The 1 standard that was not evaluated, that was previously evaluated, is the VMT standard because it was in the process of being updated. As we discussed throughout the adoption of that new standard, had we evaluated it in the same way that we had previously, it would have been out of attainment, even though the goal of nitrate reduction has long been achieved. I did misspeak last month. I think I mentioned that we would be including in the final evaluation this time the new transportation and sustainable communities category and the new standard for VMT per capita. Those actually will not be evaluated for status and trend until the 2023 evaluation, which will be our next 4-year increment. Because again, the 2019 evaluation is focused on environmental conditions and results in 2019. And so that was not a standard for this evaluation, but we will be updating the dashboard and updating that information to include the standard. It just will not have a status or trend call until the next 2023 evaluation. Next slide, please. In terms of trends, again, no changes from the draft. The vast majority, 96% of our standards are either stable or are improving. And again, if we move quickly to the next slide, this is just, again, a quick summary of those trend changes. So 51 of our standards had little or no change. And again, that is the goal for the vast majority of these standards that call for either non-degradation of a resource or for us to maintain a significant value like our scenic programs. 25 standards are improving. And again, we've called out on this slide those areas where we're seeing those improvements. We had 3 standards that are deemed to be declining. And again, we talked about these last month, particularly the air quality standards where we're seeing our extremes go up in the frequency and intensity of those extremes. But we're seeing, at least in the ambient, the average numbers are still in attainment for those particulate matter standards. And again, 67 of the standards had no trend determined. The vast majority of those because either there's insufficient data to evaluate or no target to evaluate the standard against, because they're policy statements that have been implemented in the regional plan. I do want to on the next slide, please, just spend a quick moment addressing the comment that in the discussion we had with Jennifer Carr last month about the changes that are made to the evaluation. Again, we made no substantive changes between draft and final, but what we have done is set up a process for us to take snapshots of those pages and to provide the public with access to that content. And this includes not only the 2019 evaluation, but we will also have the ability to view prior evaluations. And this is what allows us to continue to make iterative changes throughout the next 4 years prior to the 2023 evaluation that allows us to update the threshold dashboard without changing the content of the final threshold evaluation for 2019. And so these are really important changes. And based on the comments that we had in the discussion we had last month, we went ahead and made this publicly viewable in the dashboard. So if you go in through on any of our indicator pages, any specific threshold standard page, there's a link that says to view this page in the threshold dashboard. And on that page, you will have the ability to view the 2011, the 2015, and the 2019 threshold evaluation determinations by clicking on the icons. And at the very bottom is this new section that we can see on the slide here that says evaluation history. And this is where those snapshots of the draft versions and the final versions of those evaluations will be stored in perpetuity. And so you can see when those drafts were made, when the changes were made. And as you can see at the very bottom, one step that we've talked about with our consultant in terms of rolling out, and again, we will iteratively work on this in advance of the 2023 evaluation, we'll call out specific areas that have been modified so that you can see with a red box or a green box where those specific changes are on the page. But all the content, including interactive maps, the threshold status and trend calls, all of that information will be packaged together by hitting this view button on the draft or on the final version once it's published. So this is an incremental step that we've made following the meeting last month. On the next slide, again, just, you know, really, the threshold evaluation is a key element of the agency's adaptive management system. And, you know, it really, the last two evaluations, the 2011 and 2015 evaluations and their peer reviews, really set up our threshold update process. And, you know, we identified and prioritized several areas. We're going to get back to that, and we're going to get back and accelerate the threshold update process. You know, obviously, you know, having just finished the first substantive change with VMT and the first new threshold category in, you know, 30 years, we recognize that we need to move more quickly. And so, you know, the areas that have been prioritized, water quality, that area has already been recommended for numerous changes that the Science Council and the Threshold Update Stakeholder Working Group have already recommended we move forward with. And so you'll see those coming forward soon. The Stream Environment Zone standard, with the baseline assessment that was completed this year, we now have the ability to better identify our targets and better revisit those standards. And we'll be moving that forward in partnership with the Tahoe Interagency Executive TIE Steering Committee and that group. The sustainable recreation continues to be a priority area and one that again our threshold standards are ripe for update. And vegetation, you know, this is an area where a large number of our standards we didn't have sufficient data for. Or we weren't able to report on because of some ambiguity in the standards. And so we will be looking at those. And again, the threshold evaluations are a significant tool for us to shift our resources, to look at our priorities, particularly those of the EIP, and to drive policy changes. And so that's really the next step of the threshold evaluation is now we have our sort of point in time look, and now let's move forward with the adaptive management as a result of that. So that's where we are. Happy to take questions and we'll go forward from there. The dashboard itself, like I said, you know, there were no substantive changes that have been made, but we will not actually publish the final evaluation until we have that opportunity, because again, we'll be taking snapshots of the pages. And so we want to make sure that we've incorporated all public comment from today's meeting and any comments that are received at the governing board meeting. And then we will publish the, you know, what is the final evaluation at that time. If there's any questions, I'm happy to take them now.
Great, thank you, Ken. Really appreciate the update and for coming back to us again. Really important effort for the basin, so we're happy to be a part of it. Let me go now to APC members. Please go ahead and either put a, let me know in the chat box that you'd like to make a comment, or you can go ahead and unmute yourself. Okay, let's see. Mr. Young, I'm going to go to you first. Do you have a question?
Good afternoon. Hi, thank you. These are always some of my favorite presentations because the thresholds are just so central to everything that we do. So thank you. I am, however, always curious about the thresholds that don't make it into the evaluation. And then you see the ones that will go for two cycles that don't make it into the evaluation. And I'm just always curious about how those decisions are made about what to evaluate and what to leave alone cycle after cycle. So it's just a curiosity. Thank you.
Yeah, you know, the short answer is really that the standards that we don't report on are generally those that we either don't have data to evaluate, where either TRPA or our regional partners or local partners simply don't collect information on those standards. Or the more likely case is that there are standards where when they were adopted, there was no, you know, the standard may read something like, you know, reduce or maintain quality from 1982 value. But no 1982 value was ever established as that baseline value. And so, and there's no data collection that informs what we are supposed to evaluate it against.
So and if you again, don't have these a baseline, are. Yeah, okay.
Exactly. So there's no way for us to determine whether we're in line with a 1982 value if there's no 1982 value to compare to. So in those cases, again, we have prioritized the threshold update for us to then specifically go in and define a new target, define a new goal, and then we will be able to set up our monitoring programs to then report relative to that updated goal. And so that's the vast majority of our water quality standards are sort of fit into that category. And so that's where you'll see us bring targeted updates that allow us to better, you know, water quality is such an important area, and for us to not be able to report on, you know, half the standards, obviously that's something that needs to be addressed.
Sure, thank you. That's a good answer. I didn't think that you used one of those lottery machines with ping pong balls in it. You just, you know, every few years pulled out 100 ping pong balls to see which thresholds you were going to evaluate. I knew it was more logical than that. So thanks for the answer.
Thanks, Eric. I'll go to Vice Chair Carr next, who has a comment.
Hi, thank you. So Ken, thank you so much for working through the discussions on maintaining the official state record for this new website and preserving the information as we know it today for our program history. It's important, and I'm so glad that you guys figured out a way to do that. You know, I think the new system is a really great interface for interested people, and I really applaud all the effort that you've gone to with your team to make this happen. The site is so much more interesting and accessible to the public than a paper report that gathers dust. So again, thank you. Thank you for the work on this entire cycle of threshold evaluation.
Thank you for your comments. I think, you know, it's really helped us better think about how we maintain information, and you know, we really appreciate the you know, this is such a key element of our digital transformation and our digital first internal initiative. And so we really appreciate the partnership in improving that digital transformation.
Great. Other APC members, comments, questions? Okay, let's see, hearing none. Ken, I'm gonna open this up for public comment. So again, to participate in the meeting, go to trpa.gov, excuse me. In the calendar, click on Advisory Planning Commission, June 9, 2021. There you'll find a link to the public webinar hosted on GoToWebinar. If any member of the public wishes to address the Advisory Planning Commission at this time, please use the hand-raising function and you'll be unmuted by a TRPA staff member. I'll turn this over to you, Catherine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There are no hands raised to make a public comment on this item.
Okay, I'll go ahead and close public comment. And assuming there's no further questions or comments from APC members, I am ready to entertain a motion on this item.
I'd be happy to make a motion, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Jennifer.
So I make a motion to recommend that the governing board adopt resolution number 2021 dash to be determined, issuing the final 2019 threshold evaluation.
Great.
Chair, I'd like to second. This is Garth.
Garth, thank you. All right, we have a motion and a second. Tracy, could I turn this over to you for a roll call vote, please?
Mr. Young?
Yes.
Mr. Teixeira?
Yes.
Ms. Roverud?
Yes.
Ms. Stala?
Aye.
Ms. Jacobson?
Yes.
Ms. Simon?
Yes.
Mr. Hill?
Yes.
Mr. Drew?
I think Jason had to sign off, Tracy.
Okay, thank you. Ms. Carr?
Yes.
Mr. Booth?
Yes.
Mr. Drake?
Yes.
Ms. Chandler?
Yes.
Mr. Olling?
Yes.
Mr. Ferry?
Aye.
Mr. Chair, that motion passes.
Thank you, Tracy. Thanks again, Ken. Appreciate your time. I'll see you on the Little League fields.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, that wraps up item 6B. I'll move us now to our final item, which is item 6C. This is an update on greenhouse gas inventory, including a report and climate initiative update. The TRPA staff report can be found on page 67 of your packet. And I'm going to go ahead and turn this over to Devin Middlebrook.
Mr. Chairman, before Devin starts, I'd like to provide a little context, if that's all right.
Fantastic, John. Please go ahead.
Thank you. I think it's important just to spend a minute talking about all the collaboration in the region that's gone into getting us to where we are today. What Devin's going to be presenting is an update to the greenhouse gas inventory, but the original greenhouse gas inventory done prior to 2014 was funded by the CTC, and it underpinned the Sustainability Action Plan that won a Sacramento, California National APA Award. And Devin will talk about how much of that's been implemented. Since then, the California Energy Commission funded PEV planning that we did jointly with Truckee Donner PUD. And it covered the corridor from Interstate 80 to US 50. It also, and I remember that being at the luncheon where Devin received a couple of awards for that from the Nevada APA. As the MPO, the TRPA is responsible for working on the regional transportation plan slash sustainable community strategy, which includes
the mobile component of greenhouse gas reduction. And that, in that, we work with California Resources Board, both DOTs, and work with them to implement their climate, state climate policies, which Nevada has really enhanced what they're working on there recently. As you know, you talked about a little bit at the last item, is our newest threshold standard on transportation and sustainable communities. One of the three outcomes from that is greenhouse gas reduction. We've now built climate change considerations into all of the EIP categories, and that results in climate being integrated and considered as part of the project selection and funding that goes on with the EIP committee. And finally, what I wanted to point out is the CTC, and thank them again, because they funded this update. And not only does it deal with greenhouse gas emissions, but this time it includes sequestration. And you'll see, I think it's pretty clear, the link back to regional plan lands that we wanted to restore for environmental reasons before we really got into climate change and greenhouse gas. And now you'll see, get greenhouse gas reduction, now you'll see the added value of that. So the point is, we've collaborated with a lot of partners in the region. All of us have collaborated together to get where we are today, and I think we're continuing to move this forward and get better and better at addressing climate change. So I just wanted to put that context out there and thank our collaborators before Devin got started. So thank you.
Thanks, John. Take it away, Devin.
Thank you, John, for the introduction, and thank you, APC, for having me today to provide an update on the greenhouse gas inventory, which was recently completed, and an update on our climate initiative. Since the last time I've been before the APC presenting on climate, several key milestones have been reached in advancing climate action. On the right there, you can see a logo. The Conservancy just released their Tahoe Climate Adaptation Primer, which summarizes known or projected climate impacts to the region and what regional partners are doing to address those impacts. On the planning side, we obviously completed our greenhouse gas inventory, but also at a statewide level, I just want to point out that Nevada released their first ever state climate strategy, and many of the strategies identified in that plan align with TRPA and the region's existing goals. The city of South Lake Tahoe also adopted a climate action plan. And then in 2014, when we did that original climate plan, greenhouse gas inventory, and our award-winning Sustainable Communities program, we did set a goal of reducing 15% of our greenhouse gas emissions by 2020. And a little spoiler alert for my presentation, we did achieve that goal 2 years early. So that's something I wanted to make sure didn't get lost in the presentation. Clearly, if we're meeting our goal, or at least our 2020 target, we're doing things about climate change. And we really are. On the mitigation side, reducing our emissions, we have 184 adopted actions at various levels from state, local, and regional in the region addressing those emissions. You can see on the chart, the red bars show the percentage of total emissions each category is responsible for. And those green dots are corresponding to the percentage of those actions that address those. So you can also see that our actions are targeted and targeted to where those emissions are coming from. And on the adaptation side, over 325 actions across a variety of themes that all tie back to our environmental improvement program are identified. And many of these actions, both mitigation and adaptation, are being implemented or have been implemented. So the importance of updating our greenhouse gas inventory on a regular basis is to track that progress, to see where we're going, see what actions have made an impact, and where we still need to prioritize additional reduction actions. As John mentioned, for the first time, this plan, this inventory looked at not only human-caused greenhouse gas emissions, the carbon dioxide that we're putting out, but also what carbon dioxide is being sequestered into our natural landscape, primarily through our forests and meadows. In 2018, you can see the breakdown of emissions. Similar to The 2013 inventory, transportation and energy usage are our highest sources of greenhouse gases. One thing to note here, from 2013 inventory to today, natural gas did pass electricity as the number one source for greenhouse gas emissions. And you can also see it broken down by jurisdiction, and then boating emissions are identified as well, but not attributed to any individual jurisdiction. As I said, between 2005 to 2018, greenhouse gases did reduce significantly, which is good news. But however, in 2015 to 2018, the emissions did slightly increase, which shows that the continued need for action and investment in mitigation efforts is needed. I will note just the one increase of over 1,000% in wastewater is not due to those emissions actually increasing that much. It's more of an accounting and how greenhouse gases are measured from that sector, from the old inventory to the new inventory. As you saw, electricity and energy usage in buildings is the number one source of greenhouse gases in our region. And that really does come from our built environment, our buildings. And as we all know, our legacy development in the 1950s and 60s in the run-up to the Winter Olympics is still around today, and something that our regional plan goals and policies is to redevelop that aging infrastructure into to compact mixed-use town centers and more energy efficient buildings. This inventory used a tool called Urban Footprint to start to model the potential greenhouse gas savings from doing these energy efficiency projects and environmental redevelopment. And you can see just on that scale, just from younger to older buildings. And then there's a tool through Architecture 2030 called the Zero Tool, which sets some targets for greenhouse gas reductions in building usage. And you can see those goals there. So we can start looking and modeling and calculating potential greenhouse gas energy savings on top of water quality improvements, meadow restoration, and other environmental goals for the region. Looking at the carbon sequestration side, this modeled forests and meadows. As you can see, our forests are absorbing carbon, a large amount of carbon per year, but we also need to realize that we have to balance this with wildfire and forest resiliency. Obviously, we have a lot of carbon in the forest, but it's very prone to catastrophic wildfire, which would then not only threaten our local communities, but release all of that carbon back into the atmosphere. So that is not necessarily a sustainable or resilient annual sequestration in our forests. Meadows, there is more variability as well. Degraded meadows can emit carbon. They can be a net carbon emitter, while healthy meadows can be a carbon sink. Ken, in his presentation, mentioned the meadow SDZ inventory that was done last year by TRPA. We can start to link meadow restoration projects and certain restoration techniques to their benefit for not only water quality, habitat, fisheries, but also starting to link that to carbon sequestration benefits. And then when you stack that all together and you're having these environmental redevelopment projects that are restoring wetlands, you not only get the greenhouse gas savings from the energy efficiency and reducing those energy emissions from the buildings, but also added carbon sequestration. So you're really starting to link and create that full picture of the regional plan and the benefits to not only the environment, but climate change. When you put these together, we have created the first ever balance sheet for carbon emissions in the Tahoe Basin. There is no established protocol or methodology for developing balance sheets. So this is really some cutting edge information and science that we're looking at in the Tahoe Basin, and hopefully can start setting an example and spread this to other regions across the country to start looking at. But as you see, again, there is wide variability from us being a net emitter to a net carbon sink. And I think that is very important to understand that as we move forward, both the states of California and Nevada have identified carbon sequestration in natural lands as a key tool in the climate toolkit. And Tahoe has an opportunity to be a net carbon sink for both states, which can potentially unlock funding in the future. But we also have to realize that on that other end of the spectrum, absorbing all the carbon we can into our trees and our meadows is not going to be the ultimate solution and doesn't get us to our long-term goals, so we need to also reduce emissions. So we need to attack the equation from both sides. Using this inventory going forward, TRPA and partners can use this to help prioritize future management priorities. model climate benefits, as we saw, you can start to look at, okay, if the Upper Truckee River, the conservancy project that is happening now to restore that, what does the carbon look like now, carbon sequestration look like now? What does it look like after the restoration project is done? And then you can start to calculate benefits of future restoration projects. You can also prioritize transportation and built environment projects in terms of energy savings in addition to other threshold categories. And then there is obviously, because we are getting into the carbon sequestration and some of these cutting edge equations with this balance sheet, there is a lot of future science and data research that we can work with folks at the Tahoe Science Advisory Council to answer those questions. In terms of next steps, our climate initiative that we have at TRPA is all about integrating across our plans and implementation programs. We've always done climate and sustainability. We haven't always called it that, but now we have better alignment between SB 375 and our regional transportation plan, our award-winning sustainability action plan, and then implementation through integrating climate in the Lake Tahoe Improvement Program. I think a great example of that is Tahoe West and the future climate scenarios that they did on that project as they move from planning to implementation. And then also we want to look at adaptive management across TRPA's planning, implementation, and science through land use, transportation, and natural resources. I just want to point out here, as John mentioned, zero emission vehicles are a key strategy in our regional transportation plan to meet our GHG reduction targets. And electric vehicles, the state of California and Nevada are both investing heavily in electric vehicles. And actually, we just had Homewood Marina opened their first charging station for electric boats. So we're starting to see those boating emissions get reduced through electrification as well. And then sustainable recreation and tourism. That is something for the last year since the COVID pandemic and before, regional partners have been working closely to address those challenges, and climate change really plays a key role in those as well. When you have considerations of loss of snowpack in the future, warmer temperatures in the valleys to our east and west driving tourism up here, that climate piece is really, really important to consider. And TRPA has been engaging on a global stage with the Future of Tourism Council on developing toolkits for climate readiness for tourist destinations, and something that we'll have more information on in the near future. And then just to sort of summarize the themes of how we're engaging the region on climate, it's all about regional collaboration, developing priorities for the region to become resilient and adapt to climate change, and also those mitigation actions, and how do we prioritize and develop new projects and goals for the region. I covered the integration and adaptive management. The education and outreach is a key component. I included in the packet an infographic of the greenhouse gas inventory, just really easy ways to communicate to the public, stakeholders, and partners on what we're doing for climate and how they can help. And then always being informed by science data and analysis to make sure we're going in the right direction and we're using the best available information. So while that was a quick update with a with quite a lot of information in it, I will now open it up to, if anyone has any questions, turn it back to you, Mr. Chair.
Thanks, Devin. Yeah, lots of information in that relatively short presentation on just a huge topic. So really cool to see. I really liked seeing how TRPA is integrating across your plans and bringing climate more into the forefront. That's so critical, and it's really good to see how you're thinking about that. I have a couple questions, but I'm first going to go to APC members. Go ahead and send me a chat if you'd like a question or comment for Devin, or unmute yourself and speak up, please.
Hello, can you hear me?
Hello,
this is Judith Simon. I'm just wondering, since in the last year or so, and maybe longer time period than that, there seems to be a real proliferation of trash around on the roadsides, or and where would that fit in your criteria?
Yeah, there is a category when we do measure waste as an emission. So that is the landfill emission. So when hopefully all of that litter gets picked up by nonprofits like Clean Tahoe or volunteers at the League to Save Lake Tahoe. That does go to the landfill, and those emissions, primarily methane, are captured in the inventory.
Thank you.
Thanks, Ms. Simon. Other comments or questions?
I think maybe I will just ask Eric Young at Washoe. Devin, you mentioned that your hope was that some of this methodology and the model that you've built may be noticed and picked up, adopted elsewhere, maybe as we do sometimes, manipulated to fit their own geographic special situation. Have you heard from anybody? Do you get inquiries? Do you know if anybody else anywhere is doing what you just presented to us, or are you still waiting for those phone calls and emails to come in?
Yeah, no, actually I was blown away by the response and some of the outreach. So I've already had a call with some consultants that do a lot of climate work and greenhouse gas inventorying for some counties in the Southern Bay Area. And they were interested and inquired about integrating this into their work. And then we also served on the Nevada Governor's Office of Energy Greenhouse Gas Inventory Working Group that was part of the development of the state climate strategy. So we have been sharing this information and these results with the state of Nevada as they develop their protocols. And they did identify better measuring and understanding carbon sequestration as a key action in their state climate strategy. So we definitely started to see in California and Nevada folks that are interested in replicating this.
Very cool. Any other comments or questions? Devin, I was just going to ask about, I was curious in the report to see that massive reduction, I think in 2010 or somewhere around there, between 2010 and 2015, and read that it was the landfill methane capture system. Are there any other big wins like that that we see on the horizon? Are there any other big facilities like that that are, you know, do a retrofit, or there's funding for retrofits that we can anticipate bringing our numbers down so significantly like that?
Yeah, I think the methane capture on landfills did have a huge impact on those emissions to bring it down. While they're overall a very small portion of our total emissions, every little bit helps. And I know we've had conversations with South Tahoe Refuse about working with them to increase their methane capture. They just did a presentation about what they're doing on green waste, and they're diverting more and more of that green waste to composters. And that green waste has a lot of that methane associated, a lot more methane when it breaks down than something like paper or an aluminum can that ends up in the landfill. So those pieces, and I know STPUD is working, the water purveyors, since they have to pump wastewater out of the basins, are one of the largest energy users in the basin. So the South Tahoe PUD, the city, and several other partners are currently working on a large solar energy project. And I think that will have a huge impact on those energy emission sectors.
Cool. All right. Very good. Last call for comments, questions for Devin. All right, I'm going to open this up to public comment. To participate in the meeting, go to trpa.gov. In the calendar, click on Advisory Planning Commission, June 9, 2021. There you'll find a link to participate in the public webinar. If any member of the public wishes to address the Advisory Planning Commission at this time, please use the hand-raising function and you'll be unmuted by a TRPA staff member. I'll turn it over to you again, Catherine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There are no hands raised to make a comment on this item.
All right, thanks, Catherine. I'll go ahead and close public comment. And Devin, we'll thank you very much for coming and presenting this information to us at APC. And I'm sure we'll be talking more about this down the road. So thank you.
Yep, thank you all, and have a great afternoon.
Same to you. All right. We are now on to reports, item 7. I'm gonna pass this over to Mr. Hester for the executive director report. And I'm just gonna summarize one quick thing we talked about in our briefing meeting was perhaps a new methodology moving forward where John may bring updates back to APC for items that we had voted on or recommended for governing board approval to see how they navigated their path through the final process for adoption or amendment, et cetera. So, John, I don't know if you want to highlight anything on that, but we'd welcome anything that you have to offer.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, that's exactly what my report was going to be, was the entire package on vehicle miles traveled, per capita threshold, the regional transportation plan update, and project impact assessment was approved by the governing board, which is, as you know, a huge multi-year undertaking. And so appreciate the APC's work on that. And as you heard from Karen, the housing work will be moving forward, but it will come back to you before it goes to the governing board. But it will be at the working group meeting this afternoon. So other than that, nothing else to report, but be happy to start bringing back the results of your actions. I think that's a great addition, Mr. Chairman.
Great, thank you, John. I'll go now to Mr. Marshall for the general counsel status report.
No report, Mr. Chair.
Short and sweet. Thanks, John. All right, APC members, I will now be turning to you for any relevant updates you'd like to provide the group. We always like hearing from members on relevant items. So I'll go first to Mr. Alling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The only thing that that I have to note is last Thursday, the Douglas County Board of County Commissioners approved me for a two-year term effective this month through May of 2023. So I'm going to be here for at least another 2 years.
Awesome. Good to hear. We're happy to have you. Thank you, Garth. Mr. Booth.
Hey, thanks, Mr. Chair. I have nothing to add today. Nothing to report.
Thanks, Sam. How about Ms. Chandler?
Nothing to report today. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Susan. Mr. Drake?
Nothing to report today. Thank you.
Thanks, Kevin. Mr. Gavon? Do we still have Eric?
Yes.
Hi, Eric.
Hi. Just a little bit sad that I didn't make John's executive director report with the governing board approving the Washoe County Tahoe area plan on May 26. So we're all in Washoe County very excited about that. And we've been talking about how to move forward with the prioritization of our big long list of implementation items. But thank you to the governing board and to everybody once again for helping us get that done.
I'm sorry you didn't make the report either, my oversight.
I'm just teasing, John. It's okay.
I'm serious. I'm sorry.
I'd like to.
You want to say, you want to jump in, Ms. Simon?
I don't know. Were you calling on people in order?
I am. I'm just going through a list, but I'd be happy to go to you next. I just did want to mention that you have replaced Mr. Calicrate on the APC. Is that correct?
Yes, that's what I was going to mention. I was just appointed at the last Washoe County Commissioners meeting.
Excellent. Do you want to give us any brief background about yourself?
I'm a lay member by profession. I have been a librarian, a professor of English, and a lobbyist out in California, but I've lived in Nevada now for close to 20 years.
Great. Well, thank you. We're so happy to have you and appreciate you joining our group.
Looking forward to serving. Thank you.
Great. Welcome. All right, I'm going to keep going down my list to Mr. Hill.
Nothing to report this month. Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Thanks, Kevin. Ms. Jacobson?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a few items. I just wanted to point out that the Placer County Workforce Housing Preservation Program, which is a deed restriction program for to try to preserve our workforce housing, that is being launched. It was approved by our board this last year, but it's being launched in July. And then in addition, we have the micro shuttle pilot program, which I think I spoke to last month. That is launching on July 1st as well. That's a free on-demand service for Placer County in the Tahoe area. And then also just a heads up that our VMT threshold for Eastern Placer, so this is the area outside of the basin for Placer County, is going to our board on June 22nd. So we were kind of holding off on that until the TRPA VMT threshold was adopted. And so we're excited about moving that forward. And then finally, I just want to point out that we did receive an application for the redevelopment of the Boatworks Mall site. So I'm pretty excited about a redevelopment project coming forward here in Tahoe City that is really, I would say, appears to be in line with the vision for our town center of Tahoe City. That's it for me.
Cool, thanks, Crystal. Let's see, Mr. Letton left, Ms. Ferris left. I'll go to Hillary, Ms. Roverud.
I don't have a specific report, but I just wanted to acknowledge all the work that all the agencies in the Tahoe Basin area, TRPA, as well as local agencies and private partners are doing what seems like a flurry of activity with all kinds of projects, programs, and initiatives to work to address the housing issues that we're all facing. It's like putting out a fire with a squirt bottle, I think is what our housing manager had said to me the other day. So just wanted to acknowledge that there is a lot going on in that area. It's a huge issue and will take a lot more effort, I'm sure. But just kudos to everyone that's working on those things.
Agreed. Thank you. Ms. Stoller?
Hi. Thanks, Mr. Chair. I just have one quick report out, and that's that next Monday, June 14th, we'll be hosting a groundbreaking ceremony for the Spooner Front Country Project. That's the development of the Visitor Center and Amphitheater at the Spooner Unit of Lake Tahoe Nevada State Park. And that event will start at 10 a.m. Many VIP speakers, golden shovels, pomp and circumstance. It'll be a fun time. So if you're able to join us, please come out. It'll be a great event. Thank you.
Great. Thanks, Hillary. Mr. Teixeira.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Steve Teixeira. So I think TRPA and TDD are getting close to announcing the selected consulting firm that's going to help us around the region try to come to consensus on a new one or more sustainable transportation revenues. And it's relevant today in particular because, as we heard in the climate change report, transportation is key. And there's a lot of reliance on transit and trails and other non-vehicle mobility opportunities. And without an additional source of revenue for transportation and transit, we're not really going to make the dent in GHG that we know we need to do. So just wanted to add that and look forward to the official announcement. Thank you.
Thank you, Steve. Mr. Young, I believe you gave your update, is that right?
Yes, sir.
Great. I'll go to Vice Chair Carr then.
Good afternoon. Just a couple of things coming out of the legislative session that I thought I would mention. I just track the water bills, but there was a couple that I've been working with that might be of interest to folks. One is related to the requirement that the agency develop a working group to study or start to gather information on environmental contamination resulting from PFOS, PFOA, the forever chemicals you may have seen the movie about. And so that work group must be composed of representatives from interested state and local public agencies, labor organizations, community organizations, and trade associations. So if anyone is interested in working with us on researching issues related to PFOS, please let me know. Not just members of the committee, but any member of the public that may be listening. And another one was a bill that bolsters our diffuse source program or non-point source pollution program to the surface water bodies, as well as bolster our wellhead protection program, protecting groundwater. So I think the legislature did some good work in relationship to protecting water quality, and I look forward to the coming years while we implement these new laws. So that's it.
Thanks, Jennifer. I'm just gonna, in my update, make a plug for a TRPA initiative actually called Commute Tahoe. I participated in an orientation yesterday, and they're looking to survey employers of the region, which I know we all are, on providing alternative modes of transportation for staff to get to work. So there's a follow-up orientation next week, Monday the 14th at noon. Reach out to Kira Smith at TRPA if you are interested in participating in that effort. I'm sure they would appreciate that. I'm going to leave it there for reports and move us on to item 8, which is public interest comments. These are any closing public interest comments. So members of the public participating in our virtual webinar on their computer, smartphone, or tablet should raise their hand now to indicate they wish to speak, and you'll be unmuted by a TRPA staff member. Please note the Advisory Planning Commission is prohibited by law from taking immediate action on or discussing issues raised by the public that are not listed on the agenda. So one last time, Catherine, I'll turn this over to you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There are no hands raised to make a final public comment today.
All right, thanks, Catherine. That moves us on to item 9, which is adjournment. Do I have a motion to adjourn?
So moved.
Thank you. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Guessing no one opposes. So that will stand us adjourned now right at 12:12 on June 9th. And just want to thank everyone again for their great engagement and participation in today's meeting. A lot of good topics. And I look forward to seeing you all in person at some point in the future. But until then, have a great afternoon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Take care.
Thank you.
Thank you all.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.